When the Church of God began to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ very powerfully with the advent of radio, and maybe it wasn't so powerful at first, 1939 with a 5-watt or 10-watt station in Eugene, Oregon, but then it grew to be more and more powerful. And if you've ever, I don't know if any of you ever kept your old Plain Truth magazines when we had radio stations galore, but they had a listing of the radio stations the program was on. It was like 3 or 4 pages, I think. There's so many stations. They're just a listing of all the stations that you could listen to the broadcast on. And when I came into the church, I'd listen to some of those broadcasts. And at nighttime, for the most part, from 8 o'clock on, there were about 2 or 3 stations I could pick up in a row because they didn't broadcast at the same time, but they broadcast one after the other, and so you just knew where to tune on the dial. And when it got dark, these really powerful 50,000-watt stations would come on, and you'd hear Herbert Armstrong. And when he got a little bit older, and during the time that I came into the church, they had a lot of, I mean, the programs were not, they didn't have to be dependent on the time. They were timeless. So some of them were recorded, and Garner Ted was on there as well, did some during that time when I was coming into the church, and I'm sure that's the case for you, but the work of the church and the Church of God, the Radio Church of God, then Worldwide Church of God, was built on radio. There's no doubt about that, and a lot of people came into the church as a result of listening to the broadcast, and in some ways, you go on back far enough, and this is going to be a little bit difficult for some people that are fairly new to the church, but as far as religious broadcasting is concerned, it was really kind of the only game in town. There weren't many other religious voices on the radio, but boy, oh boy, if you were a trucker, you'd hear some of these programs. You're driving in late at night across the plains of the United States. You'd pull in WAI in San Antonio, 50,000-watt station. It might be blotted out by one of the Mexican stations, which had, I think some of them had 1 million watts. It was really high. And then over in Europe, you had Radio Luxembourg, which was incredibly powerful. I think it had 1 million watts, too. I may be wrong. And that just seems like what it was. It was very, very high, but it, you know, went out to all Europe. And it really was kind of the only game in town. And nobody else was really broadcasting in that way from a religious perspective. So some of our audience may never have been exposed to that late night journey of listening to the truth for the first time. But some of you did. And we had a lot of truckers come into the church as a result of that. Some of them were the only ones that were listening on the radio. We had a lot of truckers come into the church over time as they traveled the nation's highway. So during those years, I would have to say there was probably less religious tolerance than there is today from the mainstream churches, a little less tolerance, because one of the things that Herbert Armstrong and the church was accused of early on, and probably because some of the ministers of the Protestant churches and maybe some bishops and priests of the Catholic Church would have their parishioners challenge them after listening to the broadcast. And the one thing that it always came around to that they got challenged on was that was the teaching that was consistent from 1939 on for many, many years about the law and about the law of God and about how the law of God needed to be kept. And so some of these mainstream ministers began to push back at that time. One of the ways that they pushed back was this. They said, oh, that worldwide, and then we weren't really all that big. But they feared because the broadcast was big. It was huge. It was like a very, very powerful church, but you have 100,000 people supporting you and you're collecting tithes and you're using that to preach the gospel. We were taught, or we were accused early on, of teaching salvation by works. Why? Because we emphasize keeping the law. And it came down to one specific law, but many churches had and have taught that the law was nailed to the cross, so you don't have to keep the law. Well, you know, along with their other misinterpretations of the New Testament scriptures, and along came the Worldwide Church of God, Radio Church of God, and Herbert Armstrong teaching that the law must be kept, and then the controversies began. This happened through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. Well, what law should Christians obey? What law is incumbent upon us as Christians? And what is the law anyway? And then what about the statutes? What about the judgments that are mentioned in the Bible? What role do they play? And what about the sacrificial laws? And do they have any part in the future? So which laws of the Bible have authority today? Which laws should we keep? Which laws should we observe? That is the title of the sermon today. Which laws should we observe? Now, let's go back to the accusations. Some of you young people, you never heard some of these things before, but some of us lived it. We knew what some of the churches were teaching about us. But let's follow the logic, because they said that the Radio Church of God and the Worldwide Church of God taught a salvation by works, or that if you kept the law, they were teaching that we said that you'll earn salvation by keeping the law of God. So let's follow the logic of these folks. And I kind of gave a highlight of this a month or so ago in another sermon. But Exodus 20, you can turn to it in your Bible. You know it is the Ten Commandments. And let's just briefly recapture the Ten Commandments. No other gods, no graven images. We're not to take God's name in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Honor your parents. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't bear false witness. And don't covet. The Ten Commandments. Now, which of these laws were used by other religious bodies that accused us of teaching salvation by works? Well, it wasn't this. That church believes that they can earn salvation by honoring their parents. No, they didn't accuse us of that. Maybe they just made it the entire law. Or they didn't say, look at that church of God teaching salvation of works by teaching their members not to commit adultery. You know, they didn't say that. Or that church thinks they can earn salvation by not stealing or not murdering or lying or coveting or having other gods or not taking God's name in vain or having graven images. You know, they usually got around to the fact that we were teaching salvation by works because we taught that the Sabbath should be kept. And so that's how the whole thing got turned around, because they would never endorse not keeping these other nine. But, you know, it was that Sabbath that was nailed to the cross. And the Jews kept the Sabbath, so we shouldn't keep the Sabbath. And they're the ones that killed Jesus, so... You know, that's actually one of the arguments that Constantine used, as I covered last week in the sermon on the Smyrna era of the Church of God. It's these Jews. You see what they did? You don't want to be like them, so we'll keep Easter instead of the Passover. We'll keep it at the same time all throughout the whole territory. Well, none of the accusers of us teaching salvation by works would teach their membership that they could willfully break the commandments, except they would come down to the Sabbath day when their members would bring up to them, well, why are we keeping the Sabbath day? We had a minister of a, can't remember which Protestant denomination he was, but he came into the church in the 50s, I think it was around the Chicago area, and he was a minister of that church, and he and his wife came in to Radio Church of God, and they began to teach their congregation what they had learned from Herbert Armstrong and from the Radio Church of God. And people liked it. And our minister, who visited this other minister of another church, actually visited him on Sunday when he preached, when he told his congregation that particular Sunday taught them the truth about the Sabbath. And he said, next week we're going to be meeting on the Sabbath day and not Sunday like we are today. And most of the church didn't come, but maybe a few came. But that individual eventually came into the church and eventually became ordained in Worldwide Church of God. He was a faculty member at Ambassador College when I first went there in 1972, and he'd been a part of the church since the 50s, and kind of a rare circumstance. But first of all, let's take a look at the purpose of the law. Let's examine the purpose of God's law. First of all, we'll turn to Psalm 111 and verse 10. Just as an overview, Psalm 111 and verse 10. What is the purpose of the law anyway? Psalm 111 and verse 10, it says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all those who do his commandments." So one of the purposes of the law is to give understanding to people about God, about how God thinks, and about God's standards, and about God's way. And you know, I'm sure many of you have studied the Psalms and the Proverbs, and within the Psalms and the Proverbs especially, you'll find many statements that speak about the benefits of the law of God. So that's an interesting study of and by itself, and one that we'll come back to a little bit later. During the years of the 50s, 60s, 70s, the church was growing. It was getting noticed and getting attacked. We don't get that kind of observation today. Yeah, people are more laissez-faire, more live and let live, more tolerant, you know, even of the craziest of ideas, nutty ideas that people call religious. People are just, oh, yeah, anything goes. It just, yeah, whatever you believe, you know, it's fine. Just whatever religion you choose, it's acceptable in some ways. But let's take a look regarding the purpose of the law. Let's take a look at 1 Timothy chapter 1. 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5. We'll come back to the Old Testament, the beginning of the giving of the law to the people of Israel. But 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5, it says, "Now the purpose of the commandment..." And you could just say all of the law here. You could include all the commandments. "The purpose of the commandment is love from a pure heart, from a good conscience, and from sincere faith." Now, I'm not teaching a gospel of love here. I'm just saying that to be obedient to the law is what helps you to have a pure heart and what helps you to have a good conscience, because you've been obedient to the law, and from a sincere faith, "from which some, having strayed, have turned aside to idle talk, desiring to be teachers of the law, understanding neither what they say nor the things which they affirm. We know that the law is good." The law is good if one uses it lawfully, in the right way, in the appropriate way. "Knowing this, that the law is not made for the righteous person, but for the lawless and insubordinate." That's a very interesting comment, because you know what it says in Romans 3:23, "All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God." Romans 6:23 says that the penalty of that is death. So the law then was made for all of us. It was made for everyone. This is what Paul's saying, because we have all been sinners. "For the unholy and profane, for murderers of fathers, murderers of mothers, for manslayers, fornicators, sodomites, kidnappers, liars, perjurers, and if there's any other thing that's contrary to sound doctrine," well, all of humanity fits into that box one way or another, especially when you take a look at how Christ amplified the law in the Sermon on the Mount and how he made it specific to how you think as well. You know, you just hate somebody, well, that's equal to murdering. If you have the thought of hate towards your brother, that's, or anybody else, that's like murdering as well. So when you're considering the law and the terminology law, it can be expanded to everything here. I mean, if you just talk about the law of God, you're just talking about the Bible, because God's thoughts, expressions about the conduct of man are fully captured in the Bible. And so that's a broad definition of law. The Bible. Now, man has derived some of his laws. Probably the United States is the biggest example of how a nation has embraced the law of God or the Bible and used it in its governing documents, which is true in our nation. Now, the word Torah is a Hebrew term for law, and it can include all of the following. It can include law, instruction, teaching, statute, decree, judgment, or legal decision. Want me to go over that again? I will. Ray, I'm going to go over it again. It can include all of the following. It can include instruction, or teaching, or statute, or decree, or judgment, or legal decision. Now, sometimes the law is used by religionists. Sometimes it can be referred to as the first five books of the Bible, which are called the Pentateuch, penta meaning five, the five first books of the Bible. It can also refer, law can refer to the Ten Commandments as well. So there are various other meanings, but for our purpose today, I just want to show which laws are applicable to us and what can we prove is applicable to the Church of God, to Christians today. First point. Well, that wasn't the first point. The first point was purpose of the law, in case you're taking notes. The second major heading in my sermon notes are the Ten Commandments were known and existed before Mount Sinai. The Ten Commandments prior to Mount Sinai. Notice Genesis chapter 26. Now, you all know this. I mean, you know these scriptures, but we're leading up to something here. Genesis chapter 26 and verse 5. Abram was called by God. His name was changed to Abraham, and he was given promises. And in verse 4, it says, I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So all of those things, by the time of the Exodus, had already been in place for hundreds of years. But with Israel, as it was brought out of captivity, they had to be revealed to them before, because Israel had been in captivity in Egypt for 400 years, and they had lost much of the meaning of the law of God. And they had strayed very, very far away from that, so it had to be revealed again. So even before the law was codified at Sinai in written form, written with the finger of God on tablets of stone, showing the authority came exactly from God, God began to reveal once again his laws. But take a look at Exodus chapter 16. This is a few days before Mount Sinai, right? Exodus chapter 16. God was beginning to reveal his law to a nation, to a people, to his chosen people once again. And one of the first things he revealed was what? Exodus chapter 16 and verse 28. The Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? They had just been instructed regarding what? The Sabbath day. The keeping of the Sabbath, the keeping of the Sabbath holy. And that was given to them before they ever got to Sinai. Building up to something here with the arguments that have been used against us through the years. I know this is a good refresher. Hopefully it's a good refresher. But I know that this is a refresher for most of the audience. Okay? But Sometimes we forget those old arguments, and it's likely that they'll come up again because those things do kind of rotate from in time, and they come up from time to time again and again. A common teaching among some churches was that the Old Covenant, which this was part of an Old Covenant, this is the Old Covenant. People say the Old Covenant is the Old Testament. It's not. The New Covenant and New Testament are the same thing. They're not. We've only got one covenant, folks. It's the same covenant that Israel had, as we'll see. There's no Old Covenant. There's no New Covenant. There's a covenant, because covenant means an agreement. So I'm showing you how the argument can be destroyed that others use against us, because it's claimed that that old covenant with Israel was replaced with the sacrifice of Jesus Christ in 31 AD. Now, this old covenant, that was all nailed to the cross, brothers and sisters. You don't have to worry about it. I like that Radio Church of God and Worldwide Church of God, now United Church of God and all the other churches of God teaching salvation by obedience. So that was a common teaching, and it's still, I guess, kind of a common teaching if they teach anything. Most churches don't really teach a whole lot today. It's mostly feel-goodism. You know, let's have some Christian rock music and another hymn and some more Christian rock music, and let's rock on. Let's read a scripture. Bye, folks. Thanks for coming. Pass that plate around. So, what was the covenant? Because the law of God, which includes the statutes and the judgments, they all existed, see, because Abraham kept them. They all existed prior to Mount Sinai. And even though there was a covenant that was established at that time, since they existed before that covenant was ratified, it couldn't be abolished when the testator was killed. It couldn't be abolished because these weren't brought into force by that covenant at Mount Sinai. It wasn't made official. Well, it was made official with a nation, but since they all existed prior to that time, they couldn't be abolished later on just because Jesus Christ died, because they were in force. The statutes and the judgments and the laws and the testimonies, they were all there, all in existence prior to Mount Sinai. The only thing that Mount Sinai was, and Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, the restatement of the law, was an agreement, a covenant agreement that we'll get to right now, as a matter of fact. I'll have you turn to Ezekiel chapter 16. Ezekiel chapter 16 explains what this covenant was, and you're probably way ahead of me. I hope you should be way ahead of me, but just in case you need to find this proof someday, here you'll have it. Exodus 16 explains the agreement that God had. Pardon me? Ezekiel. Did I say Ezekiel or did I say Exodus? Sorry. Hey, go to both places. Find it. Just find it. You know where it is. Ezekiel. They both begin with E. Ezekiel, Exodus, kind of sound alike, don't they? Yeah, well, I've got chapter 16 of Exodus. This is about, or 16 of Ezekiel. Pardon me, you're really confusing me now. Look, I don't need to be any confused anymore. It's Ezekiel 16 right here in the middle of the page. Chapter 16, that's how that sentence begins, okay? Chapter 16 of Ezekiel. Thank you. Anybody want to proof that out here? It's in my notes. I had a grandson born this week. A little tired. Chapter 16 of Ezekiel explains the agreement that God made with ancient Israel in Exodus 20. That's what I meant to say. Okay. Exodus, or Ezekiel. See, now you've got it. Got me going here. Wow. Ezekiel 16 and verse 1, again the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, cause Jerusalem to know her abominations, and say, Thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem, Your birth and your nativity are from the land of Canaan. Going back to their roots, going back to when God began to first deal with this nation. Your father was an Amorite and your mother a Hittite. As for your nativity, the beginning of your life, on the day that you were born, your navel cord was not cut, nor were you washed in water to cleanse you. You were not rubbed with salt nor wrapped in swaddling cloths. I don't know if they rubbed Timothy James McLean in salt. I think they just gave him a bath. They did put swaddling. They wrapped him up. You know, they wrap him like a little mummy. Wrap him up so tight. And then they put things over their fingernails so they won't scratch them. Anyway, no eye pitied you to do any of these things for you, to have compassion on you, but you were thrown out into the open field when you yourself were loathed on the day that you were born. It's not speaking of an actual human birth. It's talking about the birth of a nation. And when I passed by you and saw you struggling in your own blood, I said to you in your own blood, live. Yes, I said to you in your blood, live. I made you thrive like a plant in the field, and you grew, matured, you became very beautiful. Your breasts were formed, your hair grew, but you were naked and bare. When I passed by you again and looked upon you, indeed your time was the time of love. So I spread my wing over you and covered your nakedness. Yes, I swore an oath to you and entered into a covenant with you, and you became mine. That happened at Exodus 20. Exodus. The covenant was ratified with this nation. Then I washed you in water. Yes, I thoroughly washed off your blood and anointed you with oil. I clothed you in embroidered cloth and gave you sandals of badger skin. I clothed you with fine linen and covered you with silk. I adorned you with ornaments, put bracelets on your wrists and a chain on your neck. And I put a jewel in your nose, earrings in your ears, and a beautiful crown on your head. Well, as an aside, if God gave Israel ornaments and jewelry, then it just shows that it wasn't wrong. I'm not sure that I would put a ring in your nose if I were you, but some people do that. It doesn't look so good. Anyway, thus you were adorned with gold and silver, and your clothing was of fine linen, silk, and embroidered cloth. You ate pastry of fine flour, honey, and oil. You were exceedingly beautiful and succeeded to royalty. Your fame went out throughout the nations because of your beauty, for it was perfect throughout my splendor, which I bestowed upon you. And a lot of that splendor was God's law that was given to them. But it was an agreement. It was a marriage agreement, and it reads just like a marriage agreement between a husband and a wife. And that covenant doesn't change. It's the same covenant that you enter into at baptism. It's an agreement, as Paul explains in Ephesians 5. A marriage agreement. It's like Christ being married to the church. In verse 60 of Ezekiel 16. Nevertheless, thank you for that. Nevertheless, I will remember my covenant with you in the days of your youth, and I will establish an everlasting covenant with you. Yes, in the future, Ezekiel prophesies that this covenant will once again be renewed with all of Israel. And Paul explains that in the book of Romans, that all Israel shall be saved, and they will be a part of that covenant. So God is going to remember, he's going to remember that covenant of law-keeping, the law that he gave, which included the law, the statutes, the testimonies, and the judgments are going to be enacted for this nation once again. Okay, speaking of statutes, what are the statutes of God's law? And are the statutes of God binding upon Christians today? Now, what is a statute anyway? A statute is a law that amplifies how God has determined obedience to him. It's a further clarification of how to obey God. It's a further clarification of how you submit and revere and honor and worship God. Let's take a look at the book of Exodus 18. I'm really going to be careful. I got a couple of people that I've entrusted to the notes here. And boy, oh boy, whew, when I stray one dot or one tittle off that note, what's he doing? He's going off script. You know you do. My notes are guides. You know, I'm not held in check. You know, I can go anywhere. They just kind of, unless I lose my place, which happens every sermon I give, frankly, but unless I lose my place, I'll always come back somewhere or another. Exodus chapter 18 and verse 14. Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, saw the kind of difficulty that Moses had placed himself in because he spoke with God. And he revealed to the people of God, and Jethro could see that this was wearing him out. Now, as far as the establishment of the captains of hundreds and fifties and all that kind of thing, we'll cover that at some other point. I'm not even going to get into that as to whether or not that was the best way to do it. God allowed it. God allowed it to happen, but we'll cover that at another time. So in verse 14, so when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did for the people, he said, "What is this thing that you're doing for the people? Why do you alone sit and all the people stand before you from morning to evening?" You're wearing yourself out. You're wearing these people out. I mean, they're trying to get advice. And Moses said, "Well, because the people come to me to inquire of God. And when they have a difficulty, they come to me, and I judge between one and the other, and I make known the statutes of God and his laws." Now, again, this is before Mount Sinai, see? Statutes and laws were in existence prior to Mount Sinai. So Moses' father-in-law said to him, "The thing that you do is not good. Both you and these people who are with you will surely wear yourselves out, for this thing is too much for you. You're not able to do it by yourself. So listen now to my voice." And he had some pretty good advice here, you'll have to admit. "Stand before God for the people so that you may bring the difficulties to God. And you shall teach them the statutes and laws and show them the way in which they must walk and the work they must do. Moreover, you shall select from all the people able men such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens. And let them judge the people at all times. Then it will be that every great matter they shall bring to you, but the smaller matters they themselves shall judge. And it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. If you do this thing, and God so commands you, then you'll be able to endure, and all this people also go to their place in peace." And so he listened to that advice. It was good advice. But he helped him to show that these people already were subject to statutes and laws shortly after coming out of Egypt. And Joseph just made this simple observation that Moses needed help in judging and explaining the law further to the people. So let's take a look at an example of a statute, a law that is intended to be kept so that we may know how we might fully worship God, or better worship God. What's an example? You're probably way ahead of me on this one, but turn to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 12. Deuteronomy is a restatement of the law that was given after Sinai, and just before Israel went into the Promised Land, Moses went over the law again, now with a new generation of people, restated the law 40 years later. So, okay, let's have this fresh in mind. We're going in to inherit this land, so let's have fresh in mind all these things that God wants us to do. So in Deuteronomy 12, some very interesting things. These are the statutes and the judgments which you shall be careful to observe in the land which the Lord your God of your fathers is giving you to possess all the days that you live on the earth. Now, some of these things don't apply to us today, so don't anybody take this too literally and get out of hand. I don't want to have to come and bail you out of jail. All right? Obviously, you got to be wise enough to know that there's some of these things that you're not going to do. These were national laws, judgments, and you're not going to do them today. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations which you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. So nobody is empowered here to go out and wreck anything in any church or any graven image or anything like that. We clear? Got to watch this one over here. You shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, and burn the wooden images with fire, and you shall cut down the carved images and their gods and destroy their names from that place. You shall not worship the Lord your God with such things. This is a national command as they're going into the land. But there are other things that teach us how to worship God that are statutes that we are to keep. But you shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses out of all your tribes to put his name for the dwelling place, and there you shall go. There you shall take your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings, your hand, your vowed offerings, your freewill offerings, the firstborn of your herds and flocks. And there you shall eat before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice in all that you have put your hand, you and your households, in which the Lord your God has blessed you. So Leviticus 23 describes these holy days and the times in which they were to be kept. And God says that these are statutes that you keep. These are further expressions, then, of the law of God that are going to help you be in obedience to me as your God. So this is just one of the examples of a statute, a law which they were to perform. Now, since we don't have any, quote, heathen nations, obviously, that's already taken care of. That was when they entered in the time of Joshua and the judges and that sort of thing, and that was what they were supposed to give. But what still remains are the annual festivals that we keep today. Now, what about judgments? What about judgments? I always think that one of the best ways to learn about a word and a definition of how it's used in the Bible is to go to an example of such, a real-life example that actually took place in Numbers chapter 27. This was a judgment. This was a further expression of the law that had to be made by a judge. In this case, the judge was God, and so it became a judgment and a statute. But judges were given, and even, of course, Jethro kind of alluded to that fact, that there would be a series of captains or judges who would be in place to render judgment based on the law of God that was already in existence. Because the law states in a generalized way, and then further we find that judges helped to show the application of that, because you can't just, like the Jews came up with the Talmud, to try to cover every expression of the law of God. Like I mentioned, some of the silly laws from the Talmud of years ago. How people, you know, in every single, what about this time? What about this time? Well, if there's a question and a person couldn't answer it, there were judgments. So here is a really interesting example. This had never come up before, and it had to do with inheritance. And so God said, okay, that's right. This is what you do. So this is a judgment. Verse 1 of chapter 27 in Numbers, then came the daughters of Zelophehad, and the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Maker, the son of Manasseh, from the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph. And these were the names of his daughters, Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. Not real common today. I don't know anybody by those names, maybe a Noah every so often. But as they stood before Moses, before Eleazar the priest, and the leaders and all the congregation, and mind you, this was just before they went into the land of promise, or were to go into the land of promise. All the congregation by the doorway of the tabernacle for meeting, saying, "Our father died in the wilderness." And they quickly added, "But he was not in the company of those who gathered against the Lord in company with Korah. But he died in his own sin." He died probably a natural death. "And he had no sons." Had no sons. "Why should the name of our father be removed from among his family because he had no son?" they said. "Give us a possession among our father's brothers." So Moses brought the case, their case, before the Lord. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "The daughters speak what is right." You know, they're right. "You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance among their father's brothers, and cause the inheritance of their father to pass to them." Just a legal decision based on the aforementioned law. They had a case. And because they had a case and because they brought it forward and they weren't shy in bringing it forward, God made this judgment a lasting statute, further expression. It would last. It would continue. "And you shall speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall cause his inheritance to pass to his daughters. And if he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his father has no brothers," boy, this covers every contingency, doesn't it? "Then you shall give his inheritance to the relative closest to him and his family, and he shall possess it. And it shall be to the children of Israel a statute of judgment, just as the Lord commanded Moses." Just as that had been previously expressed, the laws of inheritance, this would be an additional law, a statute that would be given to the nation. Further expression of God's will. So that's a beautiful expression of a judgment. And there were other judgments that would be made in ancient Israel based on the law of God by able men. The precedent had been set earlier with the help of Moses' father-in-law, who was very pleased to see that nation of Israel had been released from captivity. Now, what are the testimonies? What does testimony mean? Well, if you were to go to court and become a witness and give your testimony, that would be your personal affirmation of what is true and right, and correct to the best of your memory, right? We've all seen enough crime shows, and all the way from Perry Mason to Matlock to whatever else is out there. We've seen enough, probably most of us seen a lot more trials on TV than we've ever seen in court, right? But it's a personal affirmation of what is accurate and what is true and what is factual. In Psalm 93 and verse 5, Psalm 93 and verse 5, the psalmist says, "Your testimonies are very sure. Holiness adorns your house, O Lord, forever." The testimonies of God are the personal affirmations of truth and veracity and accuracy that are also recorded in the Bible. In other words, the testimony of God. Everything about God is pure and accurate. Turn to Psalm 119, in this longest of psalms in the Bible, Psalm 119 and verse 2. "Blessed are those who keep his testimonies, who seek him with the whole heart. They also do no iniquity. They walk in his ways. You have commanded us to keep your precepts diligently. Oh, that my ways were directed to keep your statutes," which we've already covered. "Then I would not be ashamed when I look into all your commandments. I will praise you with uprightness of heart when I learn of your righteous judgments. And I will keep your statutes, oh, do not forsake me utterly. So they're all mentioned here in this chapter. Statutes, judgments, testimonies, the law of God. The entirety, really, the testimony of God is the entirety of this expression of God, the Bible. It's every aspect of God's revealed law, his statutes, judgments, and his testimonies. Okay, just a couple other things to cover here. What about the laws of the physical sacrifices? What about them? What about those laws of the physical sacrifices? I'm going to get to that. Don't worry. I'll get to it. What about the laws of the physical sacrifices? One of my friends in Ambassador Club when I was a student in Ambassador College was searching for God, and he gave a speech about how he was searching for God. He didn't know about Radio Church of God or Worldwide Church of God at the time, but he was searching for God, and he went out in the woods, got himself some wood and a grill, and made a roaring fire, and had gone down to Safeway and bought a big old T-bone steak and put that on the grill, burned it up completely, got down on his knees and asked for God to show him the truth. True story. And, you know, eventually he came to the Church of God. What can I say? That was his story. So I hope it's clear that we are intended as a church and people of God to keep the entirety of the law. So if we are to keep the entirety of the law, why don't we keep the sacrificial system? And hey, what about sacrifices during the reign of Jesus Christ? What about in the millennium? You know, some people think that there will be sacrifices in the millennium. And some I've heard this controversy ever since I became a part of the church. Oh, yes, some person says, yes, I believe we will. We're talking about people in the church saying these things. But will we or will we? Yeah, let's take a look. So if we're to keep the entirety of the law, why not the sacrificial system? Prior to the law being given at Mount Sinai, there was only one commanded sacrifice. There's only one commanded sacrifice, and you know where that is. That was the Passover. That was the first sacrifice given to a nation. I'm talking about a nation. There were other sacrifices. Don't get me wrong. Exodus 23 and verse 18, God says, "That's my sacrifice," speaking of the Passover. So there's only one commanded sacrifice. Now, that doesn't mean there weren't voluntary sacrifices. Maybe even, okay, if you want to include the sacrifice of Abram and his son, a commanded one, but that one was not carried out, as you know. But this was the sacrifice that was included with the covenant that was made, the agreement that was made in Exodus 20. This particular sacrifice was included in that covenant, that marriage agreement. And it was a part of the law. It was a part of the statutes. It was a part of the observance of God's law. And of course, you can turn to the other examples, like with Abel, gave a voluntary sacrifice of his best. And others, Noah gave a sacrifice after the waters receded. We know that. But take a look at Jeremiah. Let's take a look. This shows the purpose of this part of the law. Jeremiah chapter 7. And in verse 21, and this chapter clearly explains that these laws were added later on. When we go into the book of Leviticus, we can find that they were added. But why were they added? Because they weren't originally a part of that marriage agreement that was given to the nation of Israel. In Jeremiah 7 and verse 21, it says, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, add your burnt offerings to your sacrifices and eat meat. For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices." That wasn't a part of the agreement at first. "But this is what I commanded them. Obey my voice, and I will be your God," like Abraham obeyed his voice and kept his statutes and commandments and law That's what God wanted. Obey my voice, and I will be your God, and you shall be my people, and walk in all the ways that I have commanded you, that it may be well with you. Yet you did not obey, inclined to my ear, but followed the counsels and dictates of their evil hearts. So they didn't do what God wanted them to do. They didn't obey. So Paul helps us understand, if you'll turn to the book of Galatians, chapter 3, and verse 19, what was the purpose and when did these things come about, these sacrifices? And what is he talking about? The law he's speaking about is the sacrificial law. Now, the book of Galatians is an entire different topic to cover. They had three separate problems that Paul had to handle with this group. But one of them was, one of the problems, one of the issues that he was dealing with was that there was a group called, known in among theologians as the Judaizers, who were telling these poor Gentiles that, wait a minute, you've had information withheld. You should be doing all these other things that the Jews do. Oh, okay. So Paul had to go in and clean up that mess. And he said, what purpose then does the law serve? And the law he's speaking about here is the sacrificial system. It was added. Remember what Jeremiah said. I didn't give you these sacrifices when you came out. It was added because of transgressions till the seed should come to whom the promise was made. And it was appointed through angels by the hand of a mediator. There were temporary rituals, sacrifices, ordinances, washings that were added to the law. Why? Because of Israel's disobedience. They were added for that particular reason. Hebrews chapter 13 makes it clear that this part, this aspect, which is called law, I mean, they were commanded to do it. And they had a whole priesthood set up that would administer it, the Levitical priesthood that was responsible for administering all those things. And they did it. And it says in Hebrews chapter 10 that it was just a temporary system. Hebrews 10 and verse 3. Well, I'll begin in verse 1. For the law, having a shadow of good things to come, and not the very image of those things, can never, with these same sacrifices which they offer continually year by year, make those who approach perfect. You know, it just didn't do it. It didn't make those folks perfect. Offering lambs, bullocks, whatever it was, it did not make them perfect. For then, would they not have ceased to be offered? You know, it begs the question, if it made them perfect, why would you have to keep doing it over and over and over again? For the worshipers, once purified, would have had no consciousness of sins. Makes sense, right? But those sacrifices, there's a reminder of sins every year. For it is not possible that the blood of bulls and goats could take away sins. Therefore, he who came into the world said, sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but a body you've prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sacrifices for sin, you had no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come. In the volume of the book, it is written of me to do your will, O God. Previously saying sacrifice and offerings, burnt offerings and offerings for sin you did not desire. So those were temporary rituals, which, by the way, they were part of the law. But what is different about that? Do you know? That law of the offerings did not define what sin was. It just described what you would do as a result of sin. They were reminders of sin. And as I mentioned, there were voluntary sacrifices that existed before Moses, examples of Abel, Noah. But why were they given to Israel? Why were the sacrifices given to Israel? It should be abundantly clear. Deuteronomy chapter 29 and verse 4 helps explain. Deuteronomy 29 and verse 4 helps explain why these were given to ancient Israel. Yet the Lord has not given you a heart to perceive, and eyes to see and ears to hear to this very day. Exactly what Christ said in Matthew 13 as to why he spoke in parables. Because it wasn't given yet for everyone to come to an understanding, a spiritual understanding of God and all his great testimonies and laws and all the things he enacted for the benefit of mankind. They were unable to have a spiritual relationship with God, as do you. Paul shows the Galatians, if you'll read a little further into the book of Galatians, that they were given until the seed should come, until Christ should come upon the scene. So what about today? Well, 1 Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5, that there is a sacrificial system today, but it's a lot different. It's a lot different. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5, he says, "You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." Spiritual sacrifices. Romans chapter 12 and verse 1 shows that it's not animals, it's not fleshly things, washings and ordinances, but Romans 12, 1 says, "I therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, I beseech you by the mercies of God that you present your bodies a living sacrifice." Your own self, your own being, that's what you sacrifice today, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. So there's another type of living sacrifice today. But some people might say, wait a minute, those sacrifices are set in the Bible to go on forever. The word forever is the word translated olam. It's the Hebrew word olam. That is the word forever. Some people argue the point, but they miss the point. The Bible does say that the sacrificial rites and the rituals, the washings, belong to Levi forever. You'll probably find it. You'll go. And to avoid you having to come back and ask me this question later, I'll just explain it today. The word olam means as long as those conditions would exist. So as long as there was a priesthood, now Hebrews chapter 5, Hebrews 5 shows that we have a different priesthood today. But as long as there was a physical priesthood, those conditions would exist and they sacrificed. As long as there was a temple in which to offer those sacrifices, they would be offered. Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 1. "For every high priest taken from among men is appointed for men in things pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sin. He can have compassion on those who are ignorant and going astray, since he himself is also subject to weakness. Because of this, he is required, as the people, so for himself, to offer sacrifices for sins. And no man takes this honor to himself, but he who is called by God, just as Aaron was. So also Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest, but it was he who said to him, 'You are my son, today I've begotten you.' As he says in another place, 'You are priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek,' who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death and was heard because of his godly fear, though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And having been perfected, he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him. Called by God as high priest according to the order of Melchizedek." Need we go on? I don't think so. That priesthood superseded the other priesthood, so it's not necessary any further. In Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 18, it says, "Now where there is remission of these, there is no longer an offering for sin." Sacrificial system is no longer necessary because of Christ. And finally, in 70 AD, God allowed the destruction of the temple and the offering ceased at that time. It had been kind of brought back at different times. But of course, the Holy Spirit was made available to the church at Pentecost on AD 31, which obviated the need for a sacrificial system. You have the Spirit of God, which Israel did not have. So that's why it was added. One final point. What about Acts 15, some people say? Oh, what you're saying, what's in Acts 15? Well, what does it say in Acts 15? What were the things that the Gentiles were admonished to do? There are 4 points. There are 4 things that the Gentiles were told to do. Now, they didn't have to perform the rite of circumcision, which was a part of the ritualistic law. But in Acts 15 and verse 20, it says, "For Moses has had throughout many generations those who preach him in every city, being read in the synagogues every Sabbath. Then it pleased the apostles and elders." Oh, but pardon me, I skipped a verse here. Sorry. They concluded at Acts 15 at the conference of 49 AD that the one thing or the 4 things that they would tell the Gentiles that they needed to do, which could still be a problem, was we write to them to abstain from things polluted by idols, from sexual immorality, from things strangled, and from blood. Now, it's kind of a strange thing for us today, but in their day, those were 4 things which were problematic in some Gentile areas of the world. That is, people would offer things to idols, and some people's conscience would be hurt if they ate something that was offered to an idol when they became converted because they knew it was offered to an idol. That's covered in other parts of Paul's writings. From sexual immorality, because that was a part and parcel of a lot of their religions. Temple worship, temple prostitution. Nay, that's something you can't do. That was a part of your former religion. No, not going to do that anymore. From things strangled, because that was a common practice of killing animals, strangling them. Well, God drains the blood out, right? And from blood. There are some parts of the world today where blood is considered a delicacy. God says don't do that. Don't partake of the blood. So those are the things, those are the exceptions they made. Those were 4 points of a part of the civil law of Moses. They were added to the ceremonial part because some of these Gentile peoples did these things. So we don't have these issues today, but it's good to have an appreciation for the times of the past and what happened in the past. Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews 13, we're closing in on the end, believe it or not. This is a big topic. I mean, I've tried to rush through it, but you'll have to... reason for the sermon was we had a request for this, so don't blame me. I'm not going to tell you who to blame. Hebrews 13 and verse 5. Was it 5 or... No, 13, 4. Okay. Verse 1, "Let brotherly love continue. Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by so doing some have unwittingly entertained angels. Remember the prisoners as if you were chained with them, those who are mistreated, since you yourselves are in the body also. Marriage is honorable among all and a bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Let your conduct be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have, for he himself has said, 'I will never leave or forsake you.'" I have obviously got a wrong scripture here. Here we go. It is verse 15. Sorry. We'll cut this. "Therefore, by him let us continually offer the sacrifice of praise to God, that is, the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to his name." Those are the sacrifices that we offer today. That is what we do. And that's the kind of sacrifice that God is pleased with. In verse 16, "But do not forget to do good and to share, for with such sacrifices, God is well pleased." So we do have a system. It's not an animal system of sacrifice. It's a spiritual system. There was one other area I was going to cover, but I think this is so simplistic. I'm going to cite a few scriptures and let you do this on your own. It's the letter of the law. And you'll find examples of the letter of the law in Exodus chapter 21. You know, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. A lot of people have interpreted that as the laws of vengeance. Oh, you knock somebody's tooth out accidentally, he gets to knock yours out. Or somebody pokes somebody's eye out, and you get to poke their eye out. No, that's not how it was done. And you'll find that there are various examples that are kind of, some of them are totally foreign to us in this day and age. But it just simply says that somebody ought to be compensated for their loss. And that's it. You're responsible for something, you compensate for that person's loss. If he can't work, then you pay for it. A lot of insurance laws today are built around that particular principle, that you carry automobile insurance, that if you accidentally and whatever you do, I mean, cars travel fast, right? If you have an accident, then you carry insurance, and that helps make the other party whole. Although, you know, if you are the one that is on the receiving part, you ever have your car wrecked, you know, it's like one of the car commercials, insurance commercials say, you know, what am I supposed to do, buy two-thirds of a car? Anyway, it's kind of a funny thing. But why was this a part of the civil law of God, the recompense part of law, not a revenge law? Well, Deuteronomy chapter 5 and verse 29 shows that they didn't have a heart, that they were not the kind of people, and nobody is without God's Holy Spirit, that is going to naturally want to do this. They had to have those laws to outline for them what they do. In some cases, some of the Ten Commandments, the resulting injured party, it would be up to the judge of the day to determine, okay, what is going to be done in this case? And God allowed that to happen with judges. Romans 8 and verse 7 says that the human mind is carnal. It's not subject to the law of God. And that's basically what God was saying to ancient Israel. They were going to be subject to the law of God. So God gave them this system to keep them in a habit of obedience. A sacrificial system was done for that. Now we have today the law of God that is amplified by Jesus during his ministry on the Sermon on the Mount, which helps explain the spiritual application and amplification of the laws, statutes, judgments, and the testimonies. And for the most part, the people of God are self-governing. They're like golfers. You call a penalty on yourself when you're wrong. You because you have the Spirit of God that helps you to understand that you have done wrong. And what do? You go to God's throne, just as it says in Hebrews 4, and you have a high priest there who won't forget what it's like to be a human being. You know that. Well, many years ago, our church began to be attacked with fake news. It did. Fake news that we taught salvation by obedience to the law. Nothing could be further from the truth. But we do respect and we obey the laws and the statutes and the judgments and the testimonies of God.